Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. And a big hello to all of our new listeners, both on the Thinking Fellows and the podcast network in general. I know that we've reached a new audience through a couple of the shows being on the YouVersion Bible app, which, as I understand it, is the largest Bible app in the world. And we have two shows on that platform now. We have 30 minutes in the New Testament and 40 minutes in the Old Testament on there. And from comments that I've been getting to our website and things like that, I can see that people are coming from those shows and discovering 1517 and the rest of the podcast.
Awesome.
Through there. So welcome if you're somebody who is discovering 1517 and the Thinking Fellows and Lutheran Theology through our new presence on the Bible app.
Is Adam at the beat?
No, it's a background. It makes me feel good. Do we need to clear some air up, Scott, about...
Well, we probably should.
Yeah.
So we recently had some clarifying conversations with Caleb, and we are convinced that he is indeed not a flat earther. So all of you online that are taking it seriously that Adam and I have been joking with Caleb about flat earthism can stop, because Caleb is indeed not a flat earther.
Right. I love my iPhone and satellites far too much for that. So
I did make him give me the full argument for the case for a round earth.
And he did.
After 20 minutes, I was convinced, and I said, okay.
Case for the round earth. I don't even know if I could make a case for that.
Well, for the
apart from
the circuit, you know what?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know the proper terminology.
The spherical.
Spherical earth.
Spherical earth. Yeah, no, it's be careful. Be careful what you, how far you say something on a podcast, or if you don't have room to explain your whole dive into flat earth claims. I think on a show, I said that I dove down the rabbit hole or something, and I didn't elaborate that I definitely came out the other side of the rabbit hole. So as I was doing that.
He did dive down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, I did. I looked into it. I mean, the claim was interesting.
And, of course, everybody on Twitter or whatever puts the worst construction on your
I think some of the listeners of the show who are calling me the Flat Earth Lutheran online, I think it's also in jest, but
okay,
I did want to clear the air for anybody who might be taking that seriously. Don't want to discredit anything else I say on the show because of it. So, and now with that, of course, we are in our Why You Should series of episodes, and we've been bouncing around through various types of topics. We've done some epistemology, some apologetics, some theology, and today, with that, I thought we might do an episode titled Why You Should Have a Theology. And, of course, you know, the Thinking Fellows could, you know, make a bunch of arguments for why you should have a Lutheran theology, but perhaps today we stay just a little broader and go with a theme that is, I think I'm seeing it more often in the popular culture where people admit or claim or defend the fact that everybody has a theology or a religion, even if you're not religious in the classical sense of the word. Of course, our friend Dave Zoll has taken this on in his book Seculosity about the various religious habits of this secular world and
culture.
Which is just getting worse. And I recently finished a book called Apocalypse Never.
Yeah, me too.
Which I found to be a very excellent book, and the turn at the end of that book, I don't think you can spoil like an informative book, right? That's not how that works. Spoilers only work for entertainment.
Like for novels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The end turn of that book was essentially threefold. Identifying that the climate movement in geopolitics, and particularly the West, has acted in a religious manner. He then, his second step is to sort of attack the way that it's been religious in almost a classical religious sense. And then his turn was to actually say, this has to be religious. Human experience is, and here's an alternative good climate religion or human, right. or humanitarian or religion.
Humanist
religion. Yeah. And so, so that was interesting, right? Because here was somebody identifying a secular type of religion, identifying a bad version, and then giving
an
alternative.
It was pretty good because he even claimed that there's like a liturgy to the way that they speak yes. about it and everything. And mm-hmm. it was pretty good.
And so I think, you know, this is a good topic right now because even from a secular perspective, he made the argument why people should have a theology. He just thought it should be a different one than traditional climate theology, mm-hmm. that it should be an alternative humanist one. And of course, we might argue for a Lutheran theology or Christian theology. Or
it's Michael Schellenberger. His more recent book is called San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I read that too. It's very good.
Does he define theology? I mean, if he's making the claim that everybody should have a theology, is that defined?
I think
very broadly?
He's defining it as a non-empirical set of beliefs. Okay. In a sense. So.
Okay. Interesting.
Whereas he at the end of it makes an argument for what you might call a materialist sort of secular humanist approach of containing your beliefs to things that can be empirically verified. And so for him, that expressly, I'm almost 100% positive, eliminates, you know, God and sort of quote unquote theology proper, you know, words mm-hmm. about God proper, mm-hmm. Out of the conversation. But his point more is that that for, you know, all of recorded human history, humanity has needed a theology to believe in, to give it meaning and purpose. And mm-hmm. that meaning, once we sort of abandon the Judeo-Christian form of that meaning and purpose is now being filled for many people. And even brings up like Greta Thunberg and her parents' statements about how this, when she got to be an activist in this, it gave her life meaning in a way and helped her with her mm-hmm. depression and all this type of thing.
And I think he makes the same claims about his own humanism.
And his own climate activism when he was younger. Because he was a climate activist. But at any rate, I think it's difficult to argue with the fact that when sort of, if you talk about the climate debate, when it's spoken of as an existential threat, to say that that's not then a theology, because you've now taken it out of sort of the empirical world and quite literally brought it into the existential world, you know, yeah. the world of the meaning beyond, you know, what can be encountered physically here on Earth.
Right. So let's set some ground for this. If we're going to, you know, make a case for why everybody should have a theology, I think Adam's right. We should probably set a definition for theology. You know, the very basic starting place is to just break the word apart. It's two pieces, theology, at God and words.
Yeah, right? Words about God.
And yeah, that's the classic sort of way of doing that, is that when you're doing theology, you're speaking or writing or displaying words about God.
Mm-hmm. Two sort of approaches to that, really. You can sort of speak words about God that you feel are true, right? That you maybe even have some sort of interpretive experience that you think are meaning, that those experiences are meaningful, and then you're speaking about them and connecting them to God, or God can sort of intervene in your reality and reveal himself to you mm-hmm. and give you the words about himself, which is sort of the Christian approach here is usually one where it's a revelatory thing.
Any revelatory religion would fall into.
Any revelatory religion would fit into this, where God has revealed himself and has either given the words for people to write down or has literally manifested himself, as we would say with Christ, in incarnate, and the words were then, that he spoke, literally, were then recorded by other people.
You know, there's a old passage in Plato's Phaedo. So that would be 5th century BC, a long time ago, where Plato and his friends are discussing what's going to happen to their teacher Socrates, when he dies, what's going to happen to his soul? And they get into a debate over the immortality of the soul, whether it is immortal or not. And there's a great line in there where one of the persons, I think his name was Simmias, says effectively, humans are prone to develop theories about, you know, big explanations of reality, about metaphysical unseen things and so on.
Yeah.
Yes. That he describes it as a sort of normal human enterprise. They just have to, you know, they have to give our overarching explanation to things. And he says that you can go with somebody else's theory about the way things are, or you can develop your own theory. But then there's this line in there where he says, of course, if you want certainty, it would have to come from a theologu.
Yeah, from the
theos logos.
A word from God.
A word from God or theology. And it's interesting. I find it interesting because this is, what, 500 years before the New Testament's written, before the claim that in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God and the Word was God.
Yeah.
And God came and made himself or tabernacled among us. You've got this one of the founders of the Western philosophical tradition recognizing that if there is to be any certainty, it would have to come from God. Everything else is what we kind of construct, if you will, theories that we construct or worldviews or ideologies that we put together to make sense of the world. And they might make sense in some ways, but really there is no certainty there.
I think that one of the good starting points for what you bring up with Fido, and it makes me think of a conversation we just had on this road trip we were on, was that people actually need to construct these stories, these overarching meaning, something about your past, your present, and your future, where you're going, and knowing that your future eventually has an end, draws a question about what is your life, what is the story of your life, where is it going? And humans have a huge tendency to do this. We were just in the Utah desert where lots of things are dinosaur-themed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And especially like in Moab, they call it, the scenic byway there is called the Dinosaur Diamond. And, you know, you can ride around on the slick rock, and there's supposedly, you know, dinosaur footprints in the slick rock that people can identify, and many fossils have been pulled out of this desert. But when you look at the way we construct dinosaurs or talk about dinosaurs and, you know, children's books or in pop culture, it's also definite. And what we do is we actually create stories about the lives of the dinosaurs, how many they were, how they migrated, everything they did, all from imprints in stone, from bones that, you know,
scattered bones
that have an indefinite age. And what do humans have to do? We take these imprints and not only do we create an animal with features and characteristics and habits that we've never observed, we create a whole story about its life and its relationship to the world and its relationship to other animals. And now its relationship to us and our civilization, even though we've never seen one.
And if we don't learn from the lessons of the dinosaurs,
then we have some mistakes to make. You know, you think about that. We construct whole worlds all the time. Steve Jobs, like in the 90s, said something when he was, or maybe it was at the Revelation, like, one of the iPhone events, I don't remember exactly, but he said, you know, the storyteller is the most powerful person on the planet because they can create a world, they can create meaning for people, they can do things. And so, and that's what he was at Apple, right? He was the storyteller about why you needed something, how your life was going to change. Those people change things. In many ways, that's for centuries, that was religious teachers. Theologians, right? They were the storytellers. They not only told you the story about the whole world, they told you theology. Why do you care about God? Because you live in the world that God is involved with, interested in, created, and something about the purpose, the laws, the systems that are created here, and your life from here to the end has something to do with that ultimate, that untouchable. And so you have to take these experiences and put together a story about your relationship to this world and your relationship to God.
Yeah, I think Adam's quotation from Fido is, you know, it's very poignant, because the fact is that if you don't have a, you know, this revelation from a word from God, you are going to construct a word that, even if you don't say it's, you say it's not from God, you're going to say it's from some authority that is going to replace God in that picture.
The world, the universe.
Yeah.
And like the two, you know, like the discussion that Adam quoted, you're either going to believe yourself or you're going to believe somebody else. And you're probably going to be more certain if you believe yourself and less certain if you believe somebody else. And the only way to be really certain is if God comes from the outside into your world and gives you the revelation, the truth. Now, the question then becomes, you know, how do you verify that that word is from God, and on, which we should do why you should study apologetics, and we can answer that one a little bit. But it's funny, I was, when you first texted us that these were going to be the questions for today, I was thinking more of sort of from personal experience, and Adam has had more of this personal experience than me, because he actually, I think, went to Mariners for a time. Did you not, Adam?
No.
Oh.
No. I went to the Vineyard, man.
Oh. You'll have to school me on the difference.
Actually, I've never set foot in a Mariners church. So.
You'll have to school me on the difference between the two.
I don't know if there is. I was feigning offense.
Oh, okay.
Trying to get with the times. I'm offended at everything, you know.
Oh, okay. Well, back when he and I were at university, this was a discussion in the church from the other perspective, from the perspective of Christians arguing that you shouldn't have a theology.
You should have a relationship.
You should just believe the Bible, you know? And so this was actually like a mantra, is that, oh, we don't have a theology, we just believe the Bible. And, you know, which is in itself, of course, a theology. Is that a thing anymore? Or did we sufficiently stamp that out? Because I remember coming along, you know, with the conversation, like I just said, everybody has a theology. Everybody has a confession. It's just whether or not you know what that theology or that confession is, on and on and on. And I feel like that's maybe been sufficiently stamped out, Adam. Yes, no?
I think largely so, though. I still every once in a while hear little slogans like deeds, not creeds, comma, man. Deeds, not creeds, man.
Comma,
but it's pretty rare.
Okay.
I think it's still a conversation in evangelicalism, but it's not by no means centerpiece or even like a secondary. It's marginal.
Right. As some of these, what were in our day, Adam, called non-denominational churches have definitely become denominations. I think they've probably had to shed some of that language a little bit.
So this is maybe then making an argument for why you should know your theology,
yes,
rather than why you should have one, right?
Could we add to that why you should know your theology and why you have it?
Yeah.
The White Horse Inn, you know, their mantra, I don't know if it still is, used to be know what you believe and why you believe it.
Yeah.
I think that's very good.
Because if we believe, and I think that certain people have identified this right, like Zal and other social commentators, right, that people are waking up to the fact that everybody has a religion. The argument needs to be about knowing what yours is and what your system is, because the world is a washing machine, right? If you don't know what your theology is, you're going to get tumbled around. You're going to get shifted.
Right.
And it's not just a story shifting. The implications for your whole life shift, and what we understand today is that causes immense harm, both personally, like anxiety, instability, like social, feeling like a social outcast, maybe being isolated from people, all sorts of things, and cultural instability as landscapes rapidly shift and people in the workforce and various industries don't know how to adjust, right? And that's one of the arguments about even that climate religion was just that with how quickly people are in or out, you didn't know if you were in or out anymore. And if you didn't know, your whole world could change in a matter of weeks, right?
Yeah, and I think the other big part sort of on the climate side, and you could say this about any sort of secular, what we would probably identify as secular religion of our time, is that there's definitely a priesthood involved that has all of the information and is quote-unquote handing it to you, you know, maybe in part, maybe in whole. That was one of the great things about the biggest thing I learned about the Schellenberger book, from the Schellenberger book about sort of climate science, is all these sort of studies that are quoted, what are being quoted are the synopsis of the studies that are produced by the committees to whom the studies are submitted to and not by the writer. And yep. That when the writers are contacted about the synopsis, you know, when he contacted these writers about the synopsis and what the synopsis said, he'd say, that's not what I meant intended to communicate at all. From my sort of, you know, because they write, of course, 150-page analysis of the study that gets down to a 2-page synopsis that's then reported on. And so that's not very different than sort of the old view of the priesthood pre-Reformation, where they had all the information handing down to you the parts that they want you to hear.
Yep.
You know, which was sans the gospel oftentimes. And oftentimes they're the parts that they're handing down to you are the parts that they can utilize to control your behavior. Mm-hmm. And so then that's what happens. Mm-hmm. You should be very aware of that, right? So that falls into the know what your theology is, know why you hold that theology. And the third thing I'd add to that is, you know what the sources of information are on which you're basing this theology, because your sources are everything. They're literally everything.
Yeah, I mean, to get back to...
Because you're not going out and collecting climate data.
Well, to get back to 2 episodes ago, right, and our episode on why you should know something about the Reformation, is, you know, sola scriptura, which comes up in the Reformation after a period of abuses in the Catholic Church by this system of authority for behavior control and other types of political control, is essentially saying we need a theology as Christians... we need words about God, but those words have to be from God.
Yeah.
And so the source for our words about God is that they're from God. And so thus, when theologians or theologies disagree, we can go look at the words from God to see if what we're saying about him, if we're saying back to him what he's already said about himself.
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Or we're saying to the world something he's said about himself.
I mean, this is an extension of our epistemology conversations that, you know, you if you live your life without sort of an idea of why you hold the beliefs that you hold, you're very susceptible to being drawn hither and yarn by anybody that is eloquent.
Well, nobody is immune to propaganda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about climate or environmentalism or climate change, religion or whatever. There's another one I think that is just as profound these days, and it goes by different names, but like the wokeism,
mm-hmm.
You look at that closely, it's very much like a religion, a Gnostic religion. You know, right. You get, I don't want to get autobiographical here too much, but let's say you work for an institution and somebody deems it to be an institutionally racist or white supremacist and you ask, well, how can that be? Give me some examples. And they might respond, well, you can't see it because you're white. And then maybe a social scientist.
You can never know because you don't have the secret knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we need that specialist who already has that sort of worldview.
Secret knowledge.
To inform you how it is racist or white supremacist or something like that.
Go ahead.
But it's interesting because say more secular, more sharper or critical-minded secular thinkers would say about, say, parts of Christianity that, like, especially like the Reformed tradition, where they impose a worldview on the biblical text and they interpret the biblical text in light of this worldview or something like that. Secular ideologies or religions, whatever you want to call them, do the same exact thing. You have to believe that there's a sort of systemic racism to be able to see it. Right? It's not something that's objectively there that you can discover. You actually have to believe this whole package deal first before you can see it. And that's just bad epistemology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody trained in thinking epistemologically, thinking in and abductively, will be able to see through that pretty quickly.
Can you explain abductive, abduction?
I think the best way to describe, so inductive is, of course, the, you know, reasoning from very particular things to a larger conclusion. Abductive is the way it's usually described as drawing the best inference from everything. Let me think of another way of putting it.
I don't think that's a bad description at all, because it's being open to all the information and drawing the best conclusion that you can.
Yes.
So you're always going to be on the side of, you know, on this side of the gate of certainty, not on the inside, but with enough information to act.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're always open to altering what you think is true, depending on evidence or wisdom and so on and so forth. Sadly, you know, both of you have been in higher ed and in some capacity or another for a long time. I have as well. What we used to be taught, Scott, in courses in critical thinking or informal logic or philosophy of religion or epistemology, that's not even taught anymore. Hardly. What? You have to really go looking for that.
Seriously?
Sort of approach. Yeah. There. I mean,
I guess it wasn't taught at CUI. Although Susan Bachman was there for my first 3 years there, and she still taught some of that.
Yeah. When we were at Irvine, I think
Dr. Kennedy.
I transferred, and I don't know if you transferred in or not, but I didn't have to take it. There was a freshman seminar, I think they called it, that was they read Jim Sayre's book, The Universe Next Door. And it was an exploration of the various worldviews, but it's not just a description. It will dissect them from an epistemological vantage point. It was very, very helpful.
So,
and also Why Believe Anything at All.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So as we get into the why,
we should have Dr. Kennedy on the show. Cool. He used to teach critical thinking at CUI. I can get a hold of him.
So as we get to the why you should know your theology thing, I think it'd be good to make a case for just how powerful theology and theologies have been in the past, and that, you know, knowing or realizing when you're fighting against one or on the side of one might be very helpful, right? Like in the history of humanity, various theologies have changed the score of world history. And various ideologies that are religious have as well, right? And so in your own world, you may need to look for religious movements, theologies that are changing the world around you, and knowing if you're a member of that particular theological group or not, right? One of the first things about setting up a theology or having one is knowing the boundaries, knowing who's in and who's out. And as you have your own, or you're part of a confession, a theological confession, and the world has its own individual theologies and theological confessions, it's good to know which one is acting, right? And where you are in the scope of
it. It's bad to believe you're neutral if you're not. You know, it's all, if I will say this, and Adam can maybe disagree with me, if postmodernism has given us anything positive, it's the scorning of feigning neutrality. And
I'll agree with you there.
Yeah. And I think that we're circling back on that now. I think statements like just trust the science feigns neutrality. And it's not neutral. It feigns that, you know, the science is neutral, and it's often not. You know, just trust this, that, or the other. You know, those actors aren't neutral. And so we should learn the lessons of the modern age that postmodernism tried to teach us, and not feign neutrality, and put our cards on the table. These are our presuppositions. We're not coming into this blank slate. I believe this, this, and this. And it's informing my decisions as I do X, Y, and Z. And I think that's the best case scenario for knowing your theology. I think the same thing, you know, this can apply to your secular life. This can apply to your life in the family. This can apply to your life in the church, to your three estates, right? If people know that sort of you have an epistemology that is kind of implicitly empirical and sort of leaning towards abduction, that's going to help them as you have conversations with them about why you voted this way, or why you go to this church and not that church, or why you belong to this church body and not that church body, and why, geez, in our case, why you prefer solid law gospel preaching as opposed to other types of preaching,
right?
And why you think that's important, very important for the church, for you individually, for your family, for your kids, and on and on and on, you know, and why you think you can make a case for that.
And maybe you'll be able to actually, like, do something with that knowledge then, right? You might be able to change something out of space that you live in or work in or whatever in a way that benefits you and your neighbor because it's not only informed by your theology, but you have the why of having a theology as well, right?
Yeah.
Can we ask the question, how do you know if you have a good theology? And how can you detect a theology or an ideology that's masquerading as a theology?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because what I see, and maybe this is me, maybe it's because I'm just super sensitive and offended by everything, but I see folks who I would that use the same language as me. We have the same shibboleths or cliches, if you will. But the way they, when it comes to the way that, I hate saying it this way, but that theology is lived out, if you will, the way that theology informs like your day to day, I see some, I won't label groups or name names or anything like that, but where their theology is actually more working more like an ideology. That is, it's kind of a more about power and
setting up opportunities to topple or take over.
Rather than
describe, confess, and live within the terms of who God is and who you are in relation to him. Which is,
and pigeonholing people. So you might have, there's heterodoxy and orthodoxy, or heresy and orthodoxy, if you want. But then within orthodoxy, there's those who are even more orthodox. You know, there's the endless quest for purity. Reinheit, I think, would be the German. You know?
Right.
And I don't know. I don't want to be, again, I'm a very sensitive man, as you all know.
I do know that, actually.
It's maddening when all of a sudden, I think within our own larger group that we've moved amidst for over a decade now, Scott, 2 decades, how that group of, in our world, confessional Lutherans have splintered into all their little subgroups.
And how much, I even have some guilt for how much a part of that I was early on.
Me too. Absolutely. Yeah. But then, you know, sometimes you wonder, you might be with people that say the same things and speak the same language. I'm not just talking like English, but you know, you're interested in the same sort of nuances and so on. But then you start asking, you start wondering, do I really belong to this group? Or, you know, if they knew what I really thought, am I really free to express or ask this particular question? Cause it might be be perceived as coming from a point of skepticism or disbelief. I think that gets problematic. Very quickly. And that's what in the world of like social science or political science and philosophy, that's what, intellectuals in that field would call not theology but ideology.
Yeah.
And there's a fine line between a, let's say, confessional theology and ideology. And I think the best way to identify it is if ultimately what you're claiming is theological is not in principle falsifiable, then you got an ideology.
That's right. I totally agree with that. You're in the world of sort of rationalism there, where all you really have to do is construct some sort of internally coherent mechanism that doesn't necessarily have any relation to outside reality whatsoever, or anything verifiable, you know. And even if that, and especially within actual theology, that verifiability has to come from the text of Scripture.
They're reflecting back from the words of God.
And if it doesn't, it's not then theology, it's something else. And we've maybe been using sort of theology too generically here to sort of talk about secular ideologies as well. And I think it's fair at the end to say, you know, talk about sort of the climate stuff, wokeism. That's an ideology. But the point is, this ideology that's operating as a theology, right?
It's trying to answer the same questions that a theology would answer about your place in the world.
Deep existential questions and whatnot. But from our perspective, I think it's fair to say for a theology to be one worth believing and attempting to live, it has to be verifiable from the Word of God.
Yeah, I think, you know, Adam, you're saying, like, how do you know if you have a good one or a bad one, that verifiability, and certainly that it would start with that claim of, has God ever actually said anything, right? That's that question about, so if he has, any bad theology is one that disregards or doesn't interact with things God has said, right? That's instantly a bad theology. It's bad words about God. It's bad words about your place in God's world if God has spoken and you don't interact with those words first. So that's a good one. For Christians, and we can probably do this in an apologetics episode later, and for the Thinking Fellows, as I assume all of our listeners know, you know, we argue that God has spoken. And so to get even finer, a good theology be one that comes from those words. The words of Scripture, like you said. And so if we're talking about good or bad Christian theologies or good or bad, classically religious deistic theologies, it would be about ones that actually find their source and their of doctrine and practice in the text of Scripture.
And nowhere else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, in my view.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't think we've been talking about theology too generically, because I think this is sort of what I mean. It's in your book, the book that you refer to. What is it? Apocalypse Never. And it's, you see a lot of critics of the so-called woke movement or whatever you want to call it, referring to it as a religion or a theology. And I think that's all fine. For me, I tend to there's theology, and that can be a big tent. It can be anybody who is purporting to describe God and man and everything in between on the basis of revelation, God's word. I'll consider that a theology.
Yeah.
But once anything that's answers questions about God or the universe or anything in between, or man and anything in between, that is based on something else, I'd call that an ideology. And then there's this middle space where you got those who are purporting to speak about God and man and the universe and everything else, but they do so in a way, and they act in a way as if they themselves know the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm not suggesting some sort of by any stretch of the imagination, a skepticism of any sort, but I mean, even if you're doing your darndest to read and interpret the Scriptures, you're still a human being and you're still prone to fail. Even our fathers, dare I say, even people like Martin Luther, were wise enough to always ask themselves the question, am I alone wise? Yeah. That is to say, why is it I'm the only one seeing this? Or, so I think there has been I think the best of Christian theologians historically have been those who will stand firm in their confession of faith, but they're always, open to considering the fact that they might have gotten something wrong. Yeah. And I think that affects not necessarily their theology, but their demeanor, their posture. Right. I don't know, maybe I'm getting a little too personal here.
I don't think you are.
I get a little tired of being like you, Scott, being sort of dogmatic in my youth. I get a little tired of what we might call dogmatism.
Yeah.
That creates a sort of a space or an environment where even if you're trying to do your best to confess God and God's word, you feel a little worried that you might not say it right, or you might ask the wrong question, and it'll cause people to all of a sudden assign you to some group that's not quite as orthodox as they are, or something like that.
You could even say that when you're trying to communicate what you know of God from His Word and our Lutheran confessions as accurately as you possibly can after 25 to 30 years of diligent study, you worry that it's not going to be said perfectly or in the exact way that the modern nomenclature would have you say it.
I mean, not only worry, but know that like when you have as many hours of live speaking like this is on a podcast or in an event or in a blog, that somewhere you did phrase something not quite right.
Like, well, it's guaranteed that you did.
Yeah, it's guaranteed that you did. And is the discovery of that mistake like the signing of your...
Well, our modern age calls for so much information. Mm-hmm. It's not like everything, let's say everything that I write or say in a talk or on a podcast is the result of, you know, a specific 1,000 hours of diligent study and following up footnotes, because sort of the demand for information that we're a part of and that we decide to be a part of, I'm not saying I'm not being a victim here, sort of demands more immediacy, and that immediacy requires you to draw on your base of knowledge that you already have and that you should be expanding every day as much as you can as a, you know, a thought person. But I'm still, and Adam still, we're people, you know, we're trying to be diligent. But at the end of the day, if perfection is required, perfection will guaranteed not be met from the two of us or from you, Caleb, as I sit here doing a podcast while petting my dog. You know, it's like, this is the world that we live in. And, I don't know. I'm with you there. And I think I worry about within even our church body, Adam, theology becoming ideology. And, it's disturbing to me. And I think it's more of a trend now than it was 20 years ago, but maybe I just wasn't on the end enough 20 years ago and it was just as bad then. I don't know. I'm like
it's
you said,
a part of the
I'm willing to be corrected on this, on any one of these points.
It seems that within the church, maybe we could say broader church, not just our own church body or our own confession, that the world, or let's just say North America or the United States of America, has become increasingly polarized, and everybody's finding themselves in these camps. And all these camps have these theologies / ideologies, and it's almost like there's no conversation to be had anymore. You're either this or that, and that's it.
Yeah,
it's
I don't like that.
Yeah, I shouldn't say everybody in the United States. I'm sure there's farmers out there who don't give two rips. They just go to church on Sunday.
The dictation of it has to do with, you're good to go. I think the amount of, and like you said, we're part of this, the amount of content production by everybody, not just content creators on a professional scale, but personally, we reveal our theologies online in spaces like this episode that we did on social media, right? That we share information about ourselves, and then ultimately then that means sharing our theology, the way that we take cosmic and metaphysical relationships and ascribe meaning to them. We're sharing that about ourselves, and so who you are becomes maybe more obvious to more people who don't care about you, people who aren't near you, and so you then can become, like I said a couple minutes ago, one of the first steps of a theology is determining who's in, who's out, right? Having borders.
Yeah.
You get used as an example for the borders. And that's, you know, that's just because more people than ever probably know who you are to some extent.
All right. Well, I think we've done this one, so.
Very good.
It's 44 minutes.
Very nice. Well, there you go. Why you should have, or why you should know your theology. And
be careful with it.
And be careful with it. Yeah, I think that's a good lesson here.
I look forward to the why you should buy a puppy or get a puppy for those rescue people out there and train a dog.
We can certainly do it. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you would like to support the Thinking Fellows podcast, you can go to 1517.org/donate. You know, the podcast network is only able to exist with the help of listeners who become donors. You can go to, like I said, 1517.org/donate in there. You know, one of the most helpful ways you can support us is by setting up a recurring monthly donation on our website. If you're not ready to financially support the Thinking Fellows of 1517 Podcast Network yet, you can go to the Apple Podcasts app and review the show. I'll put a link in these show notes to the Apple Podcasts app on our landing page there. And even if you don't use Apple Podcasts as your platform of choice, you can please leave us a review there. Those reviews help promote the show. They help us get a little higher in search listings, and we really do appreciate the assistance there if you have the time. We will catch you next time.
Bye.